Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, September 16th. Today we continue our coverage of the state's specialty courts and learn about the origins of girls' court and celebrate the contributions of many to help our troubled teens. We check in on what's in your cart, how one shopper buys gifts for her grandchild without breaking the bank. And we learn about a Hawaii connection on a national vaccine panel. A Maui doctor was appointed on Monday. Plus, we hear about a new book that takes a fresh look at the life and times of Captain James Cook. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, this week we are spending time looking at our judiciary system. We heard about the success of drug court and other specialty courts that have targeted a cross-section of people behind bars and trying to help them turn their lives around. We recently talked with retired family court judge Karen Radius. She's a founding judge of Hawaii's Girls Court that back in 2004 was a pilot project. It became a permanent program in 2017, and its success in reducing the number of incarcerated juvenile girls was featured in a Mother Jones article last month. We also spoke with presiding judge Diane Medeiros and Valerie Lazo, who has worked with Girls Court for 13 years as a probation officer and as a program coordinator. Judge Radius starts us off by recalling that in the 1970s, it was rare to see a girl in juvenile court, but then something changed and the number soared, exceeding the national average.
We started to look at statistics, and at that point, 43% of the juvenile arrests in Honolulu were girls, compared to a national statistic of about 21% of the juvenile arrests were girls. And there were no specific program for girls. They could get help through Department of Health, sometimes through the Department of Education, but there wasn't a concentrated, specific look at them as the factors that brought them to the juvenile system and how to provide them the opportunities that young women were getting at that point.
You know, I understand that, you know, a few years ago that count went down to zero.
What went down to zero was the number of girls in the Hawaii Youth Correctional Facility, which is often called Ko'olau. There are still girls in the juvenile system, but as far as the serious offenses, long-term confinement. We don't call it incarceration. Long-term confinement, it was down to zero. And I was there about a year ago. There were only two. So we were happy about that.
Well, what do you think makes what you do work?
I think what makes it work is, one, most of the girls that we would see in the juvenile system, a lot are arrested for runaway. A lot are arrested for not going to school. A lot are arrested for minor offenses. They're not carrying Uzis to 7-Eleven and holding up gas stations or anything like that. What are the factors that bring them into contact with the juvenile system? And if you look at the amount of early trauma in girls is higher than it is in boys, that affects them, their family lifestyles cause them problems, they aren't getting to school. When they are getting to school, sometimes they're angry and they're getting into fights and other situations at school. And they don't see life as having much of a future. So one of the biggest parts of girls' court is introducing them to women who have accomplished things and introducing them to ways of life that you don't need sex, drugs, and rock and roll at 14. You can learn other things and go back to school, get engaged with the community, get engaged in healthy activities. So we have kids that have gone on to college, including all the way up to master's degrees. We've got kids who've stopped using drugs. We've got kids who have just found a better way of life, less frenetic, and often are the first in their family generationally to not be involved, to stop being involved with court systems and child abuse systems and other less savory things.
So you've broken that cycle?
Yes, in many instances. Not every instance, but many, yes.
And Judge Medeiros, you know, what have you seen? I mean, this program is being held out as a model that, hey, we need to do things better. Let's try something. What does it look like from where you sit today?
I mean, I think that one of the really important facets of Girls Court and all of our specialty courts, but one of the things that really makes it work is we try to meet each girl where she is, each youth where they are, and assess what their issues are. Judge Radius is correct in terms of, you know, we see a lot of girls that have lower level offenses, but things have also changed over the last 20 years, or maybe we've just become more aware of differences because Girls Court has done such a good job with girls that have the runaways and stuff like that. We still have them, but we've also kind of uncovered and started trying to help the girls that are victims of sex trafficking, we call them the CSEC, the commercially sexually exploited children. Those girls have much higher needs. And so we kind of juggle both types, but we try to meet each girl where she is because, as Karen was just saying, what is driving the behavior? And that's what we try to figure out. What's driving the behavior, and then how can we address the behavior?
And it sounds like, you know, these programs have been successful because you have been able to identify, you know, whether role models or mentors, people who these young girls can emulate.
Yes, we have. I think everybody in the courtroom is a mentor. We all try to be a mentor and a role model. But we've also, and Val can speak to this because she was a huge part of it, we've also done a lot to build partnerships in the community. Right now we work with an organization, Women Speaking Out, that they're just really a great organization, and they provide a lot of mentoring and a lot of pro-social activities and a lot of opportunities for our girls.
And Val, you jump in here. Like, what have you seen over the years?
I definitely think it mirrors everything that Judge Radius and Judge Medeiros have shared. I mean, when I started with Girls Court, it was a different time. I mean, I was there for 13 years, and although some of the issues are similar, I do think that the girls right now come into Girls Court with very complex lives, more than we can even imagine for some adults when we think about it. But it is important for us to build community partnerships because in the long run, you know, their time with us is temporary. You know, if they're on jurisdiction with family court, it's not long term, or the goal is not for it to be long term. So it's really looking at building a community for them that can be safe, that they can, you know, grow with and learn from in their own, you know, neighborhoods, or, you know, on their own as they move into adulthood and continue their lives, and really to stop the cycle that Judge Radius had, you know, you had asked Judge Radius about too. It's really building a new pathway for them, or helping them see what that is, or, you know, identify or unlock their opportunities.
This is Judge Radius again. We engage the families. The mother or father, grandmother, whoever's the main caretaker, needs to come to court with the child each time the child comes to court, which is usually in a round of once every month. Even if they're doing well, they still have to come to court. And the parents are learning from the other parents, learning from how the probation officer and the therapists are working with the girls. We've also had parents who've had their own prior abuse against them, had drug addiction themselves, come to realize, oh my goodness, if my girl can be getting better, if my girl can be stopping drugs, so can I. And we've had mothers go back to college and get jobs. And so it's family court. It's about the child, but it's also about the family, and not just a what did the kid do wrong and what's the punishment for that.
And I don't know if there is an example that you would like to give of something that really touched your heart when you saw this impactful change happen.
This is Val, if I can jump in really quick.
Yeah, please.
You know, more recently, And Judge Medeiros can attest to this too, but we had a girl that came to us who was definitely in a exploitive type of relationship with a much older man, didn't go to school for 2, maybe even 3 years, was very disconnected with her family. Unfortunately, she was highly addicted to meth and was using ice almost on a daily basis. And, you know, we celebrated her graduation from high school this past year. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty significant because she helped to rebuild her relationship with her grandmother, who was her guardian, as well as, you know, her sister. And, you know, and she does come from a family that has had their own levels of trauma and drug addiction. And she herself is trying to break that cycle, but she is now very much involved in doing work with the community organization that we've partnered up with. She's clean and sober, and she's actually attending community college right now. So that's definitely a success in my book, for a recent success that we've had.
This is Judge Medeiros, another recent case. Came to girls' court, a lot of trauma history. I can't remember if she was actually confirmed CSEC, but definitely at high risk, if not actually confirmed. Domestic violence in her relationship with her boyfriend, just all kinds of things going on. And she was a young lady that I wound up sending to HYCF, to Ko'olau, because every time we put her in any kind of program, she would be assaulting people in the program. And I would go and visit her at DH, talk with her, and try and encourage her. And eventually it got to the point where I did have to send her to HYCF. I don't remember exactly how long she was there. I think it was less than 6 months. But then after that, we were able to put her in another program that she didn't complete. She didn't successfully complete the program 100%, but I would say she probably completed it over 90%. And it was like she was a different person after that. Unfortunately, that was a program on the mainland, but when she came home, she was able to reintegrate into her home. She was able to graduate from high school. She stayed clean. She stopped running away. She stopped basically reconciling with the abusive relationship, and now she's working, and she's just in a much better place, and you can see it when you talk to her. Her attitude and her ideas are just so different, and she was always extremely smart, extremely articulate. I used to tell her all the time, you should go to law school. But that really touched my heart because that was a long road. We had a lot of years with her, and it took a long time, but she really did get to a much better place. I mean, we would love it if we did not have to send anybody to the mainland, number one. You know, we're constantly looking at changing girls' court to improve it, or trying to involve different, come up with different ways to improve it, I guess is the best way to say it, because the girls are constantly changing, right? And life is constantly changing. I mean, the cell phones alone and the social media is huge with our girls. And after COVID, there's just been so many changes with the girls. So one of the things that we've been talking about is girls court historically, and I apologize, Karen, you don't know about this yet, but one thing we've been talking about is girls court historically has been all women in the courtroom. But I noticed maybe about 6 months ago, that's dependent on the prosecutors and the public defenders being able to have a female prosecutor or public defender in the courtroom. And the prosecutors weren't able to do that. And so they sent a young man, prosecutor, but he was really able to connect with the girls in the courtroom, and they really listened to him. And I noticed that, and I started thinking, because so many of our girls are in either, they're either in abusive relationships or they have seen that with their mothers, that it would be good for them to have a positive role model that was a man that could talk to them without being scary or threatening or anything like that, and they could interact with him. So that's one of the things we're talking about, is having those kinds of interactions, because they also need to be positive male role models.
Yeah, so you want to meet them wherever you can, right?
Exactly.
I don't know if there's anything that you want to convey to the general public about these programs and where they work and how you're trying to tweak it.
So one of the things is we had our 20th anniversary the fall of last year, and 200 people showed up, not just kids and their parents, but also people who had volunteered with us, people who had been social workers involved in their kids' CPS cases, heads of agencies. It was absolutely wonderful. And some of the girls who came were from our very first cohort of kids. To see them as young women and doing well and being centered with their family was just heartwarming. With various funding cuts that are coming and are coming to nonprofit agencies, we got to stay alive is the first question. And the second question is, people have talked about, well, why isn't there a boys' court? To some extent, drug court has got more boys in it, juvenile drug court, but it's not quite as intensive as girls' court, so working on those things. So not every girl who comes to family court is in girls' court. If it can be handled with smaller amounts of resources, with less complicated cases, so you steal a pack of gum from Walmart, you're not instantly in girls' court. But How do we stay focused to, one, keep us going and having the good track record we've had, and two, molding with the times and what challenges the kids are facing out in the public and in their schools, and as computers and AI and other things get more...
They complicate things.
Complicated, yes.
So I want to follow up on something that Karen was talking about, because actually we have been talking about possibly starting a boys' court recently, modeled after girls' court, in that boys need good role models too. But it would have to be, I think, separate from juvenile drug court, because that's a very specific program. But we are seeing more boys with different needs. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways that we need to look at expanding our programs to help the youth. I think that one thing I would like the community to know is that we rely a lot on our community partnership. I spoke a little bit about women speaking out. One of the other things that I think is just huge, and I think, Karen, you started this with Haleakala, the National Park Service, where every year there's at least one, and in some years we've had two trips to Haleakala, where the National Park Service, not all of the girls in girls' court, but some of the girls will go there, and they'll spend, depending on the trip and depending on whether it's COVID or not COVID, like a weekend or maybe one overnight. But they're in the park and just experiencing the park. They go on hikes. The rangers teach them different things, laymaking, artistic activities. And that's just huge, because a lot of our girls have never even been on a plane before, and they're going on this trip. And I don't know when it started, but it still continues to this day.
That and Surfrider Spirit Session, which is a nonprofit that I'm still on the board of, started with, we needed something for the girls that wasn't sex, drugs, and rock and roll, some other kind of adrenaline rush. And so I asked a woman surfer who had written a book about surfing, can you get a couple of girlfriends, take a couple of my girls out surfing a couple of times? And so that nonprofit is now, oh man, I think about 17 years old. But it has continued, and it continues to see not only court kids, but also other at-risk kids in the community. And they go to Waikiki, they get a mentor, they learn to surf, and there's lessons, using surf as a metaphor for life, talk about life lessons. You fall off the board, you get back on, you try again, you work hard. That's free recreation outside, not sitting in front of a screen, not being the mean guy in town. And so boys are invited to that also. So it started with all girls, and then the boys were saying, wait a minute, how come the girls get ordered to surf and we don't? And so that was kind of fun.
Well, so it sounds like then, you had this idea, Judge Radius. We watched it grow, but it is still going strong thanks to the support of the community, of the people who care about our future, or, you know, the young generation.
Absolutely. And with the support of both Justice Moon was the Chief Justice when it started, and now Justice Rechtenwald, both of those have been supportive. And keeping the support of the Judiciary Administration is important, the support of the other agencies, the support of individuals in the community who say, hey, I can volunteer to do the following, and maybe it's only a one-day thing they can do, or a one activity, or a place that we can meet and have an activity.
Yeah, but it's stepping up to help our young people.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Thank you, all three of you, for spending time with us and sharing some of your wisdom about what we need to keep our community healthy and keep our young people thriving.
Thank you for having us.
We've been learning about Girls Court today, as this week we're taking a closer look at specialty courts in our judiciary. Tomorrow we plan to hear about the Women's Court. Stay with us. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Following last Friday's Hanaho on immigrant stories, we got this email from Peggy. She writes, I was interested to hear the piece of the German community and surprised that the Lutheran Church of Honolulu was not mentioned. I thought of this because one of the rooms in the church is Eisenberg Hall, which is named after the Eisenberg family referenced in the piece. This year marks the 125th anniversary of the founding of the church. Thanks, Peggy. You know, you inspired today's backyard quiz. Did you know there's another congregation in Hawaii that shares the Eisenberg connection? The church we're thinking of was also founded by German immigrants and built in 1885, making it older than Lutheran Church of Honolulu by almost two decades. An Eisenberg family member was a longtime minister of the church. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this other church with an Eisenberg connection? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nairit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NairitHawaii.com.
Time for another installment of What's in Your Cart. Charisse lives in California's Bay Area, but travels to Hawaii regularly for work, and she was coming out of Don Quixote near Ala Moana when the Conversation's D.W. Gibson met up with her.
All right, so you said you're a bad person to talk about shopping. Why is that?
Because I buy what I want and what I like. I'm a very impulsive shopper.
Now, I don't mean to get too personal, but does this mean you're like a millionaire and you've got like a, whatever you want to spend?
Not even close.
All right, so how do you manage that? If you go into a store and you simply buy what you want to buy and you don't have $1 million, how are you making that work?
I work really hard. I work really hard, and I don't know, I keep working so I can support my habits.
What did you buy today? What's in your cart?
Well, I'm traveling, so I bought my mom some 100% Kona coffee because it smells really, really good. I bought my granddaughter some little outfits and socks. My daughter loves Japanese food, so I bought some ramen. And that's $114 worth of stuff. Yeah, that's really bad.
No, it's interesting when you're made to confront it, right? You're like, oh my goodness, these are the few things I got for 114 bucks. Wait, so you're making a trip to the continent?
Yes, I'm going back home tonight. Yes.
So you're visiting here now?
I'm actually working here for a health and safety company. They have our managers rotating in every 2 to 3 weeks, and my stint is over.
So do you go back and forth regularly?
I was back here in March. So it just depends on what the availability is and how many managers we have rotating.
Are there differences you've noticed in terms of prices between here and California?
Yes, absolutely. A lot more expensive here. Yeah, one bag of groceries here will cost me $75, where I could probably get by about $50.
Any particular items jump out to you, or like categories, like, oh man, dairy, or like packaged goods, or snacks, or desserts?
Your everyday items, bread, milk, eggs, it's all, I would probably say, 30% higher.
And so is this a regular routine for you when you do travel to bring back a lot of goods from the islands?
Yes. Yeah, it's a bad habit. I had to buy an extra bag at Walmart just to throw in all the extra goodies.
Are these requested gifts or things you came up with?
No, just stuff I buy. Like I said, I'm very impulsive.
Well, that was Charisse from California. She spoke with HPR's D.W. Gibson outside of Don Quixote. Have you noticed the differences in the price of groceries lately? Write to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This morning, Honolulu Civil Beat and the Associated Press wrote about the appointment of a Maui doctor to a National Vaccine Advisory Council. In June, Hawaii Health and Human Service Secretary Robert F. Kennedy removed all 17 members of the panel. Here to talk about the Hawaii connection of a new member of the council is Civil Beat's Brittany Light. Good morning, Brittany.
Good morning.
Yeah, I was curious as to who this Maui doctor is. So what can you tell our listeners?
Sure. So... Yeah, his name is Dr. Kirk Milhome, and he lives on Maui. He is a pediatric cardiologist. He and his wife have medical ministry, a Christian medical ministry, in which they provide medical care to children around the world with cardiac problems, kids who lack access to appropriate treatment. And he's also a pastor at Calvary Chapel, South Maui. His name popped up in the news during the earlier days of the pandemic, and that's how some folks know him. He was doing free house calls for Maui residents who wanted to sort of stay under the radar of the state health department during those most difficult days of the pandemic, and he was providing unapproved drugs to treat COVID, including the livestock drug ivermectin. You probably recall that was a whole thing during the pandemic. So he came under some fire for doing that. And now he's just been named to this very powerful panel that, makes recommendations to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about how vaccines should be used.
Yeah, so, he was a critic of those vaccines, but I also know that, he shared some similar ideas with Dr. Lauren Pang, from Maui County, and we've had him on the show as well. Just they offered a different perspective.
Yeah, the two of them, and Pang, he's the state's top medical advisor for Maui County. They co-founded something called the Pono Coalition for Informed Consent, they sort of called COVID vaccines experimental and really advocated for some of these drugs that are unproven to work to treat or prevent COVID. So there was a lot of controversy surrounding all of this, as you can imagine. More recently, though, Dr. Milhone, he participated in a hearing hosted by Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's a Republican from Georgia. It was on the subject of vaccine injuries caused by COVID-19. And so during that hearing, Dr. Milhone advocated against vaccinating children with the COVID shots. And he alleged that COVID shots had triggered some cardiac issues in some child patients he'd seen. So that just gives you a view of his stance on the COVID vaccine.
And did you have any luck when you reach out to him or Dr. Pang?
Yeah, I did reach Dr. Milhone yesterday via email. He was in Washington, D.C. for, this appointment, which, of course, is a big deal. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to speak with him. He said he would love to talk, but the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services had required that all interviews be coordinated through the agency's media team, and those folks, you know, didn't get back to me in time. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to talk to him about his views and his goals and you know, what he hopes to represent on this newly reconstituted panel.
Yeah, and you said you mentioned you talked to Dr. Pang, but he wasn't aware of this appointment.
Yes, I did speak with him briefly, but he wasn't aware of this appointment. No.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to watch to see what this panel does. But thank you for flagging this.
Yeah, you're so welcome.
We've been hearing from Civil Beat reporter Brittany Light. You can read her story at civilbeat.org. It's been nearly 250 years since the English captain James Cook became the first European to land in Hawaii. While part of that history is familiar to many in the islands, you may be surprised about some of the details of that trip. Hampton Sides wrote a New York Times bestseller on the topic titled The Wide, Wide Sea, Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and the Fateful Final Voyage of James Cook. The Times named it one of the 10 best books of the year. Sides recently talked about the book with HBR's Bill Dorman, who asked what drew him to the story of Captain Cook.
No matter what you think of Cook himself and his voyages, I think he certainly belongs in the pantheon of the great explorers of all time, just in terms of the sheer numbers of nautical miles that he traveled and all the places he went and all the peoples that he encountered on his three circumnavigations of the world. It was such a daunting subject, three voyages, a British explorer, here I am, an American writer. I began to think, well, how would you break this down and find a narrative in this that would make sense? And I began to focus on the third voyage. I began to realize, well, here is a kind of an American story. It takes place off the coast of Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and then, of course, Hawaii. It happens during the American Revolution. It has a bunch of Americans on board, including the captain who brings the ships home, John Gore from Virginia. It is a British story, but it is also very much an American story. And I realized that in narrative terms, it would just be a lot more interesting to have one voyage. And it turned out to be just an incredibly fascinating journey for me. You know, not just the journey I'm writing about, but the journey for me to get to these places and to write and research this book at a time when Captain Cook's legacy is being reassessed and his statues are coming down and they're being ripped from their plinths and vandalized. And that actually made me even more interested. It's like, who is this guy that's so controversial after 250 years? I thought he was this stodgy, boring British guy. Turns out he's in the news all the time. So for all those reasons, I jumped in and had a real ball researching and traveling to all these places to put this book together.
Your journey of research involved clearly a lot of travel, but you also weave in indigenous stories, oral histories, more than just the British Navy's version of events. What were some of the challenging parts research for you?
You know, I think one of the shortcomings of those British narratives of exploration is that they're just completely one-sided. You know, it's sort of like to the victors go the spoils. The white dudes have to write up the story and they forget that, oh, these people that we visited have their own version of events. And they have their own perspectives. And furthermore, we didn't discover this place. They did. They were here first. In the terms of the Polynesians, they truly had done extraordinary, really almost mystifying how they accomplished their navigations to get to these islands in the first place so long ago. Ships without metal, without rivets, without nails. How did they do it? So it was obvious to me that I needed to incorporate the indigenous point of view whenever and wherever possible. But that presents a challenge because oral history is tricky. It's like, I don't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday, let alone what my great-great-great-great-grandfather said and thought and felt on a certain day in the 1700s. And yet, without incorporating oral history that goes way back in time, we have nothing to work with, essentially, when you have an oral tradition.
Cook himself coming to Hawaii, there's a lot that's been written, relatively speaking, about his time on the Big Island. But a year before that, he skirted many of the islands and landed on Kauai. And you write about that. Talk about that period a little bit.
He's going across the Pacific. He's trying to get to essentially Alaska to start searching for this Northwest Passage, this shortcut over Canada or through Canada to get to the Atlantic. That was the goal of the whole mission. When he left Tahiti, all the smartest people and the best navigators said, you know, they didn't indicate there were any islands in the middle of the Pacific. So he stumbles upon Kauai and he can't believe it. It's not on the charts. It's not on his maps. He realizes immediately that it is an extraordinary find. I don't call it a discovery because obviously the Kauaians discovered it, or the Hawaiians discovered the successive generations before had discovered it. But he was certainly the first European discoverer to land on the Hawaiian Islands. And this is one of the great things about Cook is that, you know, he wasn't content to just note an island and pass by like so many of the Spanish and Portuguese explorers did. He wanted to go ashore. He wanted to describe these people. He wanted to understand their culture. He wanted to write about the sort of the anthropology, what they wore and how they worshipped, how they thought, what their implements of war were. He wanted to describe all these things, and so he does. And for the most part, it was a nearly perfect first contact experience in which both sides, I think, were simply astounded and simply amazed at each other. It was a mutual discovery. For the most part, it was peaceful. They weren't there long enough to really introduce a whole lot of venereal disease and other diseases that came later, although that did happen, I'm afraid. Overall, in both directions, there was a mutual fascination. Now, there was an incident that happened with one of Cook's sort of junior officers where a Hawaiian man was fired upon and immediately killed. And this is like the first encounter that the Hawaiian people have with guns and with metal and with the power of firearms. And it's a shocking experience. They didn't know how these guns worked or what. They thought it was magic. They thought, you know, they weren't sure what it was. But other than that one episode, that week or so that Cook and his men were there was a beautiful experience. And when you read Cook's journals, you see his fascination with these people and his description of how happy they seemed and how vibrant their culture was and how beautifully designed their canoes were. He also was beginning to grapple for the first time with this idea of like, who are these people? They speak the same language, more or less, as the Tahitians and the Maori and the people of Tonga. And so he's starting to realize, holy moly, these guys, they spread out over the entire Pacific. How did they do it? People in canoes and thousands ashore celebrating. This was the high point of the calendar year. This was a beautiful time in their culture. And then here comes these two ships. And they came in a clockwise fashion in a way that the old myth said that Lono would return one day in giant ships with giant sails. So this is a point that has been debated tooth and nail by various anthropologists and native elders about, did the Hawaiians think Cook was Lono? Did the Hawaiians think he was a god? I kind of plead the fifth on that in the end of the book. I try to present both sides. I don't have the authority to say myself what the Hawaiians 250 years ago thought about this man, but they certainly thought something was up. There was an enthusiasm, an excitement, almost a rapture in the air as Cook and his men came ashore. They bowed down to him. They called him Lono. They chanted his name in that way. They brought him into the temple and made him the centerpiece of this, almost like a passion play. And Cook didn't do a whole lot to disabuse them of the idea that maybe he was a god. And for the first week and a half or so, Cook and his men were treated, if not like gods, certainly like dignitaries and celebrities, and treated very well. Of course, you bring in 180 stinky, smelly, hairy English sailors who are very horny and who are very bored. They've stuck in a ship for all these months. They start to overstay their welcome, let's say. After a while, the Hawaiians, who have, of course, as we all know, a very deep sense of generosity, they're like, wait a minute, it's time for you to go now, please. And Makahiki is supposed to be over now. There is a very set calendar. It's time for you to go. And Cook was pretty good about sensing when he'd overstayed his welcome, and he was trying to get out of there. And he finally does leave, and all seems to go well. But he encounters a gale a couple of days later. The foremast of his ship, the Resolution, is snapped in half, and he has to turn right back around and go straight to that place that he knew and repair his ship. That's when all hell broke loose, because the Hawaiians are thinking, who are you now? Why are you here? If we ever thought you were Lono, obviously we were wrong. You are not Lono. You are a mortal, and you are a god out of season, if you are a god. So that's when Cook's troubles really begin.
You have a line at some point where you say, on returning to Hawaii, Cook was 50 at this point. By the standards of Navy captains, he was getting old and creaky, too old to be this far out at sea, this far from home. And he seemed to have been losing a bit of what had brought him to where he was.
Yeah, I think historians and biographers have for a long time tried to figure out what was wrong with Captain Cook on this third voyage. There was something maybe medically wrong with him, spiritually wrong with him, certainly kind of emotionally wrong with him. He had done a lot. He'd seen a lot. He traveled thousands and thousands of, hundreds of thousands of miles. He was tired, but it was more than that. He would lose his temper. He was quick to use the lash on his own men. He was quick to, whenever anything went missing, no matter how trivial or small, he just completely lost it and came after the native people who he said stole it, whatever that might be. He was famous for his sort of equanimity and diplomacy skills in his first two voyages, but this third voyage, something was off. The leading theory is that he had a parasite that he had probably encountered during his first two voyages that was slowly but surely robbing him of essential vitamins and minerals that was causing brain damage. It can happen. And I think that is the most likely explanation for what was happening to him. He wasn't the same guy, but it was episodic. He had good days. He had days where he was the great captain of old. His maps were incredible. Some of his explorations of Alaska were just textbook, just like, can't believe the quality of his observations and the quality of his maps. But other days he loses it, and he just loses all sense of proportion. And that's what happened that day that the boat, the rowboat, the support vessel, was stolen from the Resolution, and he marched ashore intent on kidnapping the King of Hawaii. he didn't use his junior officers to negotiate or begin to gain some intelligence on the matter. He just marched in there and said, I'm going to take this guy. I'm going to hold him for ransom till I get my boat back. That's crazy. That's not the old Captain Cook. So, in a sense, he set in motion this whole thing that led to his own demise.
When people in Hawaii think about Cook and his arrival here, for many, it's not a positive story. How do you see Cook in Hawaii?
Well, I'll just say right off, I admire Cook as a navigator. I really admire him as a map maker, the incredible skills that he had as a captain and as an explorer and as someone who was, for his times, very, I think, genuinely sympathetic and fascinated by the indigenous people he encountered. So I think in those ways, it's unfair that he's sort of been singled out in many places, in many cases, as sort of the symbol, the emblem of colonialism and imperialism, when in fact he was way ahead of his times, much more progressive than practically any other European explorer I can think of. What I think, though, you know, is that he was first. He was the first European to arrive in Hawaii and a lot of other places. And the British also had a knack for erecting statues in a lot of places. And they, you know, you can't erect a statue to an abstract idea. You got to erect a statue to a person, I guess. And often it was Cook. And, you know, Cook, I believe he had some pretty serious misgivings about the whole colonial enterprise. I don't know that he was truly a colonist. He was certainly working for the British Empire. He understood that. But he was an explorer. And the Polynesians were among the greatest explorers of all time. And I would think that in some way the Polynesians would understand and appreciate someone like Cook, who really, you read his journals and you can tell that's what animates him the most, is describing something totally new, describing a people or an island or species of animals that never been seen before, at least by his own people. And that electric moment that comes with pure discovery is so exciting. And I really think that in the end, I know Cook's sort of gotten a bad rap. You know, it's like, I get why everything that came after Cook, because of Cook's voyages and the maps that he made, you know, all those things very quickly changed and really unraveled indigenous cultures in Polynesia, for example. The missionaries and the germs and the alcohol and the economic dislocations that came with whaling and so many other things that happened. I feel like Cook is being blamed for all of that. It's like all Cook's fault, when in fact, you know, he was kind of just the messenger of modernity. He was the guy who came. And what I like to think about is the opposite scenario, where what if the Polynesians, who were far better navigators, what if they had discovered England first? How would that have gone down, and how would history have changed, maybe for the better? I don't know. How would they have been treated in England? I don't know. That's not a far-fetched hypothetical, and it's something really kind of interesting to think about.
The book is The Wide, Wide Sea: Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and the Fateful Final Voyage of Captain James Cook, Hampton Sides. Thanks so much for making time for us today.
Real pleasure being with you. Thank you so much.
Well, that was author Hampton Sides talking with HBR's Bill Dorman about the legacy of Captain James Cook. Sides' book is titled The Wide, Wide Sea. You can find it wherever books are sold. Before we go, it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we marked the 125th anniversary of the Lutheran Church of Honolulu and noted a connection with the German businessman Paul Eisenberg. He came to the Hawaiian Islands in 1858 and managed a sugarcane plantation in Lehui. Eisenberg has been called the father of Lutheranism in Hawaii, and two Lutheran congregations share a connection to the family name. We asked you for the other church with an Eisenberg connection. We were looking for the Lehui Lutheran Church. Paul's brother Hans served as the minister of the congregation for more than three decades. And congrats to Mike from Kaimuki. You got it right. He says he's a Lutheran. That's our quiz for today. If you have one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we will hear from Hawaii Pacific University and Chaminade about the recent news that the Department of Education will cut funds to minority servicing institutions in higher education. We welcome feedback. Call our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.